So, were the pollsters right or wrong? After 2016, we were viewing them with a skeptical eye to begin with. Henry Olson at the Washington Post came pretty close, saying Biden was going to win, but not by quite the margin that national surveys had predicted.
They certainly overestimated, on average, Biden's support. Some polls were ludicrously in that direction, regularly showing that Biden would win by 8, 9, 10, 11 percentage points, when at best he's going to win by 5 when all the votes are counted. And they massively blew many states. For example, Susan Collins in Maine won by 9 percentage points. There's not a single public poll that had her ahead at all. That is a massive polling error.
And how did it happen, especially after last time? I thought that after 4 years ago, you'd see major changes in the polling industry so that screw-up like that wouldn't happen again.
Well, that's what the polling industry told us. And what's clear is that they didn't make changes, or if they made changes, they weren't good enough. That, in fact, the polling errors that we're seeing right now are significantly worse than they were 4 years ago. That 4 years ago, on average, the national polls were only off by a point or two. So nowhere near as off as the polls are now. And that's something the entire industry is going to have to reckon with.
Yeah, I heard one analysis that said it may be because of the nature of communicating with people these days, that the only people who are going to sit patiently and spend 20 minutes on a cell phone with a pollster tend to be activists.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to that. In most public polls that are run by centrist or center-left people, they overshot on Biden. And then on the Republican side, you had people who were overshooting on Trump. Somewhere, there ought to be a way to figure out how to create a balanced sample. But the mass of the polling industry seems to tend in one direction or the other and doesn't serve the public very well.
Maybe you can explain something that nobody's ever explained to me. This concept of Republican polling companies and Democratic polling companies. What does that mean? If there are polling companies that favor one party or the other, doesn't that go against the very purpose of a poll? Even the parties want accurate information, don't they?
They do want accurate information, but because of the nature of politics, if you're servicing political clients, you tend to be on one side of the aisle or the other. That, you know, if you're a pollster who works for Democrats, a Republican's not likely to hire you in another race because they're afraid that you will tell the data to another Democrat and vice versa. So if you're in that industry, you're on one side or the other. The public polling industry tends to be officially nonpartisan, but usually staffed by people who are center-left sympathizers or from liberal university professors. So you don't get a Democratic firm, but you get bias from the nature of the person who is actually writing and conducting the poll. And I think that's what we're showing. One thing that happened was the head of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee was livid on the Democratic conference call because the party's internal pollsters up and down the road had been sending them data that ended up being completely wrong. The entire Democratic Party, House and Senate polling apparatuses were producing bad data for their candidates. And that's something that they're going to have to solve if they're going to get in the game.
Yeah. Do people just lie? A lot of this is inside baseball. I don't think that it's that important to many people. I'm perfectly willing to wait until the votes are counted to hear who wins without having to do all these predictions. But the reason I don't lie in polls when I'm lucky enough to get one of these serious polls is that I want them to know what I think. I mean, I know that in between elections, politicians rely on polls a lot to figure out what to do and how to vote. And I want them to know. I don't know what it would accomplish to lie to a pollster.
Yeah, and I don't think most people do. I think the most that they would do is say they're undecided when they're really leaning in one direction or not. But there's really never been any evidence of people lying to pollsters. But we know that the response rates to polls is down below 5%. Mm-hmm. And when you're that low, if the people who won't answer a poll are not representative of the people who will answer a poll, that introduces sample bias. And it's not possible for a pollster to correct for that.
Yeah. So is this pretty much then going to be the world we live in? Because it seems to me unless we plant chips in people's brains, the only way you figure out what they think is to ask them. And if the samples are hopelessly skewed, then the information is going to be corrupt.
It's going to require a lot of rethinking. It's not going to be something where you just have to, you know, put a little fairy dust on your model and say, well, we've corrected it. No, this is a systemic and serious issue. that for many pollsters has been going for over a decade, that state polls in the Midwest almost always underestimate Republican support, period. You know, and it doesn't matter who the pollster is. So that means that there's an industry-wide problem with sampling the electorate in the Midwest. And they have to address that, or else what you just have to do is say, okay, add 3 points to the Republican margin because we know that they're screwing up.
Yeah, just have a Planck's constant for Republicans.
I actually am thinking about doing that for my projections
really?
In 2022.
Just the automatic fudge factor.
Well, I resisted doing that this time because that was kind of like unscientific. But the fact is, all of the errors were predictable in the line of what sort of errors we've seen in the past among these groups.
Henry Olson, columnist for The Washington Post. Henry, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me on.
Yes, so big opening on Wall Street this morning, up 1,500 as of now for the Dow Industrials. And there are a few reasons for this jump. I asked CBS business analyst Jill Schlesinger if investors believe that there will indeed be a new congressional relief package soon.
Last week, there was real consensus that there's probably going to be stimulus before the end of the year. That was because Mitch McConnell had shifted his stance and said that they were going to look at a bill, and that bill would likely include some money for states and municipalities, a very important component, because without extra money, these states are going to be forced to lay off their workers. So that could be another round of unemployment that is caused at the state level. The big news of this morning, talking about encouragement, is this potential breakthrough on a vaccine. And I would just caution people that although this is fantastic news, I mean, as an individual walking around, you say, oh my God, that's all we've been waiting for is a vaccine. To see the stock market rise so dramatically on this, there is a lag time between getting this vaccine approved, getting it distributed to millions of people, and everyone actually signing on to it. And in that interim period between where we have a surge in virus and the vaccine actually being distributed and people getting the vaccine, there could be a lot of damage to the economy. So it's not all good news. We want to make sure that we get our heads on straight about what actually has to happen now.
So if Joe Biden was looking for something to signal to business that he too is business friendly, what should he do right out of the gate?
I don't know if he has to do much. I think that he has to look. There are going to be things that Joe Biden has to do. He's got to fill vacancies on the Federal Reserve. He's got to create a cabinet of individuals that are going to be respected by the business community. And, you know, to some extent, I would say that Trump made a good pick when he had Gary Cohn in his back pocket. And frankly, Steve Mnuchin, while he's not considered, you know, the greatest choice as Treasury Secretary, he certainly was better than many of the others that were floated. So I think that right now, under President Biden, that one big name getting floated for Treasury Secretary is a Federal Reserve Governor named Lael Brainard. And she is very well respected and has a lot of a lot of facility talking to both businesses, to regulators, and has the economist's confidence in the ability to parse what's really happening. So, you know, look, I think there's plenty of people from which to choose. You know, I would never give political advice. I would just say that, you know, run the nation's economy in the way that is best for most people. Even the biggest Wall Street titans have said that the inequality that exists in the United States is a problem, because that inequality means that the whole economy is seeing growth that is subpar.
CBS senior business analyst Jill Schlesinger. Jill, thank you.
Sure.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. The president-elect says his first priority is a coronavirus task force. Let's call in the doctor.
Agent Dr. Cohen.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. So, I take it you agree with this as being priority number one?
Well, Dave, I think that this treatment of the coronavirus infection and COVID-19 infection has been a priority all along. It has become a political issue in the past few months, when in all reality, it's really a public health issue. So let's just think about what the decision tree looks like for coming up with a plan. So if we sort of start at the top with the notion of coronavirus infection / COVID-19 infection. That's the top. And how do we deal with it? And then under it, we have two choices. One is treatment and the other is prevention. So if we follow the treatment arm, treatment really boils down to therapeutics, medicines that we haven't invented yet. There are some that we have that we're currently using, for example, remdesivir, dexamethasone, or convalescent plasma, but these are really treatments for acute infections. So that's not something that, you know, the coronavirus task force can recommend for the general population. So then we move out of that into the prevention arm of this pathway we're describing. And this really boils down into two things, which is one, therapeutics, and the other is, you know, non-therapeutic options. So therapeutics would be like developing a vaccine, which would be prevention. And as we know, there's a race to develop a vaccine going on right now. So that moves us back into the non-therapeutic arm. And that's sort of where we've been all along. So in the non-therapeutic arm, what are the things we can do? Well, prevention has involved wearing masks, which we're already doing, social distancing, which we're already doing. And then there's some medications and things that people have talked about that have gotten a lot of publicity that may or may not help, things like taking vitamin D or N-acetylcysteine or famotidine or zinc, things like that. But we don't really know if those things work. So other than that, it involves really just wearing masks and social distancing. So I'm sort of not really sure what recommendations some new task force can come up with other than doing what we're already doing, but maybe doing it in a more prescribed or rigorous way.
Yeah. Now talk a little bit, because you've mentioned to me on and off the air about vitamin D. You're on a vitamin D regimen, and I'm certainly familiar with that as an additive to milk, something that you do to prevent certain diseases because of our cloudy climate. But what is its role in preventing something like COVID?
Well, I mean, vitamin D enhances our immune function. The problem is in the Pacific Northwest, we don't get enough sun exposure. And if you were to randomly, you know, check 10 people and check their vitamin D levels, most likely all of them would have low vitamin D levels. So I'm of the opinion, and I think a lot of people are, that anybody living in the Pacific Northwest should be taking supplemental vitamin D. In this case, vitamin D has been touted as something that can help to prevent coronavirus infection or reduce the severity of it. Now, I don't know that there's any data to actually support that notion, but that's not going to be the recommendation of a coronavirus task force. They may suggest that, but that's not going to be what changes the course of the disease.
So are you predicting that that there will be shutdowns? And if there are, would you, I mean, I'm looking at some of the figures here. It looks like we're going exponential again with the number of infections. Is that going to be the only way to deal with this?
You know, look, coronavirus is a transmittable, communicable infection, and it's transmitted from person to person. The only way to reduce the incidence of it is to reduce person-to-person contact. I don't think this is magic, and I don't think there's lots of choices. I think that there's a very limited number of choices what we can do when dealing with a communicable disease like this.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. Dr. Cohen, thank you.
Thanks, Dave.
Health officials in Washington state are sounding the alarm again as parts of the state see the worst surge in coronavirus cases yet. And with the latest, here's Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott.
Between Friday and Sunday, the state reported nearly 4,800 new coronavirus cases in Washington, including more than 1,400 new cases yesterday alone. New daily cases have stayed above 1,000 all but one day this month, with deaths and hospitalizations also creeping up, though not as dramatically yet. Health officials across the region and the country, for that matter, are warning that that could change dramatically over the next couple of weeks if people do not heed their warnings.
For the past 7 weeks or so, since the 21st of September, COVID-19 cases have been increasing in King County and regionally in Washington state and in many states across the country.
King County Health Officer Dr. Jeff Duchin.
We have reached a new peak with approximately 308 new cases reported each day last week, That's fourfold higher than late September and over 100 cases per day more than the initial outbreak in the spring. Our 14-day incidence rate is 155 per 100,000 as of Tuesday and is expected to increase. This has placed tremendous stress and overload on our case and contact investigators and on our outbreak investigators.
In the past 14 days, King County alone has seen nearly 5,000 new cases.
Testing is up through the community, and that's very good. People are taking advantage of our new sites in South King County, Renton, Auburn, Tukwila, and Federal Way. And we want to continue to encourage anyone with symptoms to isolate and get tested and stay isolated until you have your test results. However, along with the increase in testing, the countywide positivity rate has also increased from approximately 2% in September to about 3.5% recently. And this reflects increasing transmission and shows us that the number of cases we're seeing is not just a result of increased testing.
In Pierce County, the rate per 100,000 people over the past 2 weeks is 119, and it's even higher than that in Snohomish County.
Most of the new cases that have been occurring are in close contacts of known cases or those who have no occupational or personal risk factors and don't know exactly where they did get it. Those are the two leading groups. We've also seen significant increase in long-term care facility cases.
Snohomish County Health Officer Dr. Chris Spitters.
3 to 4% of hospital beds in Snohomish County below the threshold of 10% that is a danger signal regarding acute care capacity in the county. So we're currently okay in that respect, but these increasing case rates, and including the increasing rates in older adults, really across all age groups now, we're seeing increases, but including the older adults, that and the increased cases in long-term care does raise concern about where hospitalizations will go, particularly if we're not able to bend the curve down or if things take off through the older population, either in the community or in long-term care facilities.
And he warns,
what we can and should be expecting is that we'll pull it all together here and bend that curve back down and evade a hospital surge. If we don't succeed in doing that and we get more transmission occurring into the older population or among the older population, if it starts to amplify there, then we are going to have a hospitalization problem. And public health and elected officials will then have to determine how best to address that. During the first wave, we really had to shut things down.
Pierce, King, and Snohomish County are all seeing rates higher than they ever have in the pandemic, as is Spokane County, where as of Friday, the two-week incidence rate was 282 cases per 100,000 people. In King County, Dr. Duchin warns,
if we see people continue to with their usual Thanksgiving plans and gathering groups, we will undoubtedly have a very unmanageable situation coming out of that. And so we really need people to think about this holiday and think about how to make sure that next year everybody in the family is at the dinner table and we don't lose people that we otherwise would have been able to celebrate with by acting responsibly and doing everything we can this Thanksgiving. This isn't going to be happening again probably next Thanksgiving.
Bottom line,
if we don't see the things going in the right direction, we will be working with our healthcare system to look for early indicators of dangerous stress, and we will have to impose restrictions that, you know, we would rather not. We would rather have people be able to make the decisions for themselves about doing things more safely in a limited way. But if that doesn't happen, you know, if we can't get enough people behaving safely enough and cases continue to rise and we feel our healthcare system is being compromised, we'll have to make policy changes that will involve cutting back the types of activities that people can do in the community. And we really want now to bring our kids back to school. You know, we want the economy to be healthy, but we can only do that if we act responsibly in our social lives and our recreational lives and outside of the workplace. And so we have this window of opportunity now in which we're going to sink or swim.
Kai Radio's Hannah Scott.
Your daily dose of kindness. I just take a moment to thank the people that have reached out recently. I've just got a few emails recently and tweets of people saying they look forward to the dose of kindness every day. It gets their day started off real nice, and I appreciate that. I never know how these are received, so when I get notes like that, it makes me know to keep going on this four-year journey of kindness. The Daily Dose of Kindness, brought to you by Mike Novak and ListWithNovak.com. We expect adults to set the example for the young, but as I've discovered in this dose of kindness, the opposite is actually true. CBS's Steve Hartman specializes in finding those kids.
A search for hope at the end of this anxious week led me to this humble bundle. Zoe, now three, is the proud product of TJ and Courtney Thomas of Atlanta, Georgia.
Oh, look who's here. Hello. Cameo.
Back in February, Zoe was diagnosed with leukemia. And because her immune system is now compromised, she couldn't go trick-or-treating last weekend with all the other kids. In fact, her parents even had to put up a sign to keep others away. Sorry, no candy. Child with cancer.
The whole purpose was just so that we wouldn't have to keep telling kids sorry and have disappointed kids. Never expected anything like this.
Never expected those little ghosts and ghouls to be such saints.
I just immediately started crying.
There at the foot of the sign, trick-or-treaters left their Halloween candy for the child inside. Doorbell camera footage shows kid after kid making the same character-defining decision, mostly on their own.
No grown-ups were there telling you what to do?
No.
We tracked down a few of the angels.
She dumped her whole bag.
Your whole bag?
I wanted to give back to them.
I wanted to give back to them.
It's somebody's little girl.
The empathy we heard and saw, Courtney says it was just the medicine her family needed.
During this crazy time with everything going on in the world, just the gesture of, hey, we're all in this together, and just remind each other that there's still hope and love.
Still hope, love, and much better role models than the ones we obsess over.
And I know this is radio and you can't see it, but the shot of that pile of candy under that sign of kid, that's when I just lost it. I just started tearing up at my desk. But
imagine the doorbell camera catching people doing nice things.
We see that now. We really do, whether it be the Amazon delivery driver giving a little dance, or, you know, the garbage truck driver waving at the kids, making their day, waiting for the garbage truck. I mean, it's these cameras are catching the good, because you don't often see it, right? It's you're not looking for it, so you don't see it. So I'm grateful for these doorbell cams. Anyway, thanks for indulging. It's been good.
Now, from the G and Ursula Show, weekdays 9 to noon, here she is, Ursula Roitin. Ursula.
Good morning.
I haven't talked to you since the election.
I know.
You know, there are still four states that haven't been called yet. Alaska, Arizona, Georgia, and North Carolina.
Still waiting.
So we're still waiting. I know the president's still waiting. Do you think do you think it would be rude not to concede?
I hope that President Trump has an epiphany and realizes that it would be good for him, and I think it would be really good for the country. Is it necessary? Is it required? No. But I think that I would rather he not be remembered, you know, for, you know, ending his presidency in the same kind of chaotic way that many people have complained about. And I think that he could do a lot of good for the country if he were to say, you know what, I got a lot of votes. I mean, a record number of votes, but someone got an even bigger record number of votes, and it's time to concede. How about you?
I think he will eventually concede. What's the point of not conceding? He's probably, I mean, he's essentially the leader of the Republican Party still, I suppose. And from all the commentary I've read, he's the person who turned the Republicans into a working class party. And that's probably the kind of coalition they will need to keep winning elections, because as you pointed out, he got more votes this time than last time, right?
So the turnout was more than 6 million.
Yeah, so that's, you know, it's just that the turnout was higher, but it was not the blue wave that the Democrats were hoping for.
Absolutely not, and it may turn out that there is still a Republican majority in the Senate, and Joe Biden has said that he is going, President-elect Joe Biden has said that he is going to, you know, really work to try to bring everybody together, including Republicans in Congress. And I think it just would behoove President Trump to kind of give him a good start, like every other president has done at the end of a term. But the other thing I was going to say, and by the way, just in our show coming up, we are going to open up our phone line. So we encourage everybody to call 888-973-CHIRO because we want to get your reaction. But on Saturday, how did you what did you do after the race was called? What was your reaction? Did you do anything?
My reaction? Yeah. Did I do backflips or anything? No. I said, I'm gone. Okay,
if you had done backflips, that would have been breaking news. Okay.
That is true, since I've never done one. No, I mean, that's the way it was unfolding on Election Day. So I was surprised by Pennsylvania. Because as you know, I spent Friday going county by county trying to project out the the more counties I got to. I mean, he did have a lead, but Trump was getting more votes as well. And so I did not think Pennsylvania was going to go for Biden. So that was quite a surprise to me.
So the interesting thing that I did on Saturday is I met up with two of my closest girlfriends who I know voted differently from me. Mm-hmm. So they voted for President Trump, and we had dinner and we had scheduled it before I knew that President-elect Biden was going to be speaking at 5:30. So I asked them if I could actually have it playing because I didn't want to miss it. I said, we are witnessing history. And you know what, Dave? We had a lovely dinner. It was not a big deal. And mm-hmm. I'm just hoping that we can kind of move forward and just in the spirit of, hey, we're in this together. You may not be happy with what happened, but first and foremost, we are all Americans, and it's okay.
Yeah. I actually spent last night watching the first 5 episodes of Jane the Virgin, so stay completely away from politics.
There you go.
G and Ursula at 9 o'clock right here on Cairo Radio. Thanks, Ursula.
Thank you.
The pandemic has put a lot of strain on small businesses, and a summer of daily protests further complicated the situation. So let's bring in John Scholes, president and CEO of the Downtown Seattle Association. First of all, John, tell me about the condition of downtown Seattle. Have shoppers and restaurant goers started returning?
We've seen some customers returning, some workers, some visitors, but we are in a really tough spot still here in downtown Seattle. This pandemic has had a devastating economic effect on so many small businesses throughout the center of our city, with more than 130 that have permanently closed.
Now, is there a plan for economic relief? And when you say permanently closed, that sounds terrible. I mean, so these are businesses that no matter what happens going forward, no matter what kind of relief plan Congress passes, are not coming back.
Yeah, these are, you know, small restaurants and retailers that have been in downtown for some for decades, some for a couple of years, folks that we know and love, and they've said they're permanently closed. And so to save the remaining businesses that have opened their doors, we need massive federal relief, and we need more folks back downtown in safe ways, in ways that where we can keep our community safe and that don't contribute to the spread of coronavirus. But our small business community is in a tough spot right now.
Yeah. So does that end when, for example, Amazon starts calling people back to the office, or are there other factors? I noticed that the transit ridership is still, it's something like only 50%. So what changes things?
Certainly more folks working in their offices, but doing it in safe ways, following the guidelines of local and state public health authorities would be a big help to small business. There's hundreds of small businesses and thousands of folks who work in small businesses that are dependent on those other workers in their offices Monday through Friday. And most of them are still not here. We've seen some return over the summer, but the numbers remain low. And that would go a long way to helping more small businesses survive this. But so would federal aid. And we really need both of those measures right now.
Okay, let's talk about the survey that you have released this morning. This is, you did 900 interviews, and this was not one of those multiple choice surveys. These were open-ended interviews, and you essentially let the respondents pick the topics?
We fielded a survey in partnership with the Seattle Chamber that EMC Research, one of the region and nation's most respected research firms, conducted. It's one of the most extensive surveys of Seattle voters. In recent memory, 900 voters were surveyed at the end of October on their attitudes about the city and the direction of the city and public policy. So we asked issues of top concern and frustration, but we also put some specific topics to them around homelessness and safety and tent encampments in their attitudes about the city council.
And the top frustration, this was mentioned by 45% of those 900 people, was indeed homelessness. It's far and away the most concern. Affordability, cost of living came in second at 19%. Defunding the police came in third, just behind that. So this remains the number one concern after all these years of declaring homelessness emergencies. Now, was there a particular group or neighborhood that seemed the most concerned, and where did the city council come in on this?
Homelessness is a top concern across the city. It doesn't matter what neighborhood you're in. And I think we're all frustrated that 5 or 6 years into the city and county declaring a state of emergency, we are still seeing too many people in our alleys and parks and sidewalks. That's the best we've been able to offer them 5 or 6 years now into declaring this a state of emergency. And I think voters are expecting results, and we want to engage with folks compassionately and get them in better situations than Denny Park or Ballard Commons or the alley that's going to get colder and wetter as we go into winter. We can do much better than that. And I think that message is coming through strongly in this survey from voters. And they're also frustrated with the current direction of the city. The classic right track, wrong track question that's asked in just about every poll, a majority of Seattleites think our city's off on the wrong track. And that's the highest it's been in a decade that question's been asked within the city of Seattle. So I think there's a lot of frustration with the direction of the city. People want results. They want to help their neighbors in need. They think we can do better than what we're doing today, and that there's better alternatives than the neighborhood park for somebody dealing with mental illness or substance use disorder.
The one thing that sort of stuck out here was when you asked the question, how satisfied are you with the Seattle City Council? One age group in particular was especially satisfied. It wasn't a majority. It was 48%, but that was the highest percentage among the groups that you surveyed, and that was young people 18 to 39. So comment on that for me.
Yeah, just about every other demographic of the city is incredibly frustrated with our council right now, and the lack of results on some of the issues that they've reported are top concerns and frustration to them. And I think what you see in this survey and these poll results is a lot of frustration where folks don't feel like they're being heard. That if you're not willing to go protest on the front porch of a city council member's home late at night, that you feel like your voice is not being heard in some of the most critical public policy issues facing our city, whether it's around reimagining policing or how we're engaging with folks in need or how we're going to reconcile a significant deficit in our city budget. You see throughout this survey a lot of frustration that folks just don't feel like they're being heard right now on these critical issues.
In the defund the police question, again, you had this 18 to 39 age group, 59% saying that the police department needs to be defunded, which I know you guys are against. I mean, it sounds like there's I don't know if they're millennials or Generation Z or what we're calling them these days, but there is a large group of young people who really wants to change policing in a radical way.
And a majority of the city that wants to be thoughtful about how we do this, that don't support major layoffs, that don't support the approach that the council has taken to date, which has resulted in the resignation of our terrific Black female police chief and cuts to her diverse command staff salaries. They don't support the series of decisions that have been made over the last couple of months. They want to be thoughtful about this. They want just policing. And they believe we should be doing it in a responsible and thoughtful way and listening to the city and engaging folks throughout this city, that just because you don't take your evening to go shout at the front porch of a city council member's doorstep, that you deserve to be listened to as well. And we need to be really thoughtful about how we go about engaging folks throughout the city and making these critical decisions.
But who's in the room? Who's in the room discussing these things? Are your members in the room, or is it a different?
Not enough people have been in what have been virtual rooms over the summer. Not enough people have been heard. And I think we're hearing that throughout the city from small business owners, from faith leaders, from community leaders. It doesn't matter what part of Seattle you live in. You don't feel like your voice is being heard on really critical public policy decisions. And that's what comes through in this survey. That's not just me saying it. Certainly our members don't feel like they've been heard. And certainly the small businesses that we represent But I think what the poll demonstrates is lots of people feel that way.
John Scholes, President and CEO of the Downtown Seattle Association. John, thank you very much for coming on this morning.
Good to be with you, Dave.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News, the podcast. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. You can find our podcast weekday mornings right at 9:30.
And if you subscribe, you'll never miss the Daily Dose of Kindness.